Foundation and Empire by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1952 by Isaac Asimov. This recording of the reading of Foundation and Empire was published by arrangement with Doubleday and Company, Incorporated, and was produced in 1979 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. Foundation and Empire by Isaac Asimov. This book is divided into a prologue and two parts. The dedication is to Mary and Henry for patience and endurance. Prologue. The Galactic Empire was falling. It was a colossal empire, stretching across millions of worlds from arm end to arm end of the mighty double spiral that was the Milky Way. Its fall was colossal, too, and a long one, for it had a long way to go. It had been falling for centuries before one man became really aware of that fall. That man was Harry Seldon, the man who represented the one spark of creative effort left among the gathering decay. He developed and brought to its highest pitch the science of psychohistory. Psychohistory dealt not with man, but with man masses. It was the science of mobs, mobs in their billions. It could forecast reactions to stimuli with something of the accuracy that a lesser science could bring to the forecast of a rebound of a billiard ball. The reaction of one man could be forecast by no known mathematics. The reaction of a billion is something else again. Harry Seldon plotted the social and economic trends of the time, sighted along the curves, and foresaw the continuing and accelerating fall of civilization and the gap of 30,000 years that must elapse before a struggling new empire could emerge from the ruins. It was too late to stop that fall, but not too late to close the gap of barbarism. Seldon established two foundations at opposite ends of the galaxy, and their location was so designed that in one short millennium, events would knit and mesh so as to force out of them a stronger, more permanent, more quickly appearing second empire. Foundation, Nome Press, 1951, has told the story of one of those foundations during the first two centuries of life. It began as a settlement of physical scientists on Terminus, a planet at the extreme end of one of the spiral arms of the galaxy. Separated from the turmoil of the Empire, they worked as compilers of a universal compendium of knowledge, the Encyclopedia Galactica, unaware of the deeper role planned for them by the already dead Seldon. As the Empire rotted, the outer regions fell into the hands of independent kings. The Foundation was threatened by them. However, by playing one petty ruler against another, under the leadership of their first mayor, Salvor Hardin, they maintained a precarious independence. As sole possessors of atomic power among worlds, which were losing their sciences and falling back on coal and oil, they even established an ascendancy. The Foundation became the religious center of the neighboring kingdoms. Slowly, the Foundation developed a trading economy as the Encyclopedia receded into the background. Their traders, dealing in atomic gadgets which not even the Empire in its heyday could have duplicated for compactness, penetrated hundreds of light years through the periphery. Under Hobler-Mallow, the first of the Foundation's merchant princes, they developed the techniques of economic warfare to the point of defeating the Republic of Corel, even though that world was receiving support from one of the outer provinces of what was left of the Empire. At the end of 200 years, the Foundation was the most powerful state in the galaxy, except for the remains of the Empire, which, concentrated in the central third of the Milky Way, still controlled three-quarters of the population and wealth of the universe. It seemed inevitable that the next danger the Foundation would have to face was the final lash of the dying Empire. The way must be cleared for the battle of Foundation and Empire. Part 1. The General. Chapter 1. Search for Magicians. Bel Rios. In his relatively short career, Rios earned the title of the Last of the Imperials, and earned it well. A study of his campaigns reveals him to be the equal of Purifoy in strategic ability, and his superior, perhaps, in his ability to handle men. That he was born in the days of the decline of the empire made it all but impossible for him to equal Purifoy's record as a conqueror. Yet he had his chance when, the first of the empire's generals to do so, he faced the foundation squarely. Encyclopedia Galactica. Footnote. All quotations from the Encyclopedia Galactica here reproduced are taken from the 116th edition, published in 1020 FE, by the Encyclopedia Galactica Publishing Company, Terminus, with permission of the publishers. Belrios traveled without escort, which is not what court etiquette prescribes for the head of a fleet stationed in a yet sullen stellar system on the marches of the Galactic Empire. But Belrios was young and energetic enough to be sent as near the end of the universe as possible by an unemotional and calculating court, and curious besides. Strange and improbable tales, fancifully repeated by hundreds and murkily known to thousands, intrigued the last faculty. The possibility of a military venture engaged the other two. The combination was overpowering. He was out of the dowdy ground car he had appropriated and at the door of the fading mansion that was his destination. He waited. The photonic eye that spanned the doorway was alive, but when the door opened, it was by hand. Belrios smiled at the old man. "I am Rios. I recognize you." The old man remained stiffly and unsurprised in his place. "Your business?" Rios withdrew a step in a gesture of submission. "One of peace. If you are Dukembar, I ask the favor of conversation." Dukembar stepped aside, and in the interior of the house, the walls glowed into life. The general entered into daylight. He touched the wall of the study, then stared at his fingertips. "You have this on Siwena?" Barr smiled thinly. "Not elsewhere, I believe. I keep this in repair myself as well as I can. I must apologize for your wait at the door. The automatic device registers the presence of a visitor, but will no longer open the door. Your repairs fall short?" The general's voice was faintly mocking. "Parts are no longer available. If you will sit, sir. You drink tea? On Siwena? My good sir, it is socially impossible not to drink it here." The old patrician retreated noiselessly with a slow bow that was part of the ceremonious legacy left by a ci-devant aristocracy of the last century's better days. Rios looked after his host's departing figure, and his studied urbanity grew a bit uncertain at the edges. His education had been purely military, his experience likewise. He had, as the cliché has it, faced death many times, but always death of a very familiar and tangible nature. Consequently, there is no inconsistency in the fact that the idolized lion of the 20th Fleet felt chilled in the suddenly musty atmosphere of an ancient room. The general recognized the small black Ivroid boxes that lined the shelves to be books. Their titles were unfamiliar. He guessed that the large structure at one end of the room was the receiver that transmuted the books into sight and sound on demand. He had never seen one in operation, but he had heard of them. Once he had been told that long before, during the golden ages when the empire had been coextensive with the entire galaxy, 9 houses out of every 10 had such receivers and such rows of books. But there were borders to watch now. Books were for old men, and half the stories told about the old days were mythical anyway. More than half. The tea arrived, and Rios seated himself. Dukembar lifted his cup. "To your honor?" "Thank you. To yours." Dukembar said deliberately, "You are said to be young. 35? Near enough, 34. "In that case," said Barr with soft emphasis, "I could not begin better than by informing you regretfully that I am not in the possession of love charms, potions, or philtres, nor am I in the least capable of influencing the favors of any young lady as may appeal to you. I have no need of artificial aids in that respect, sir. The complacency undeniably present in the general's voice was stirred with amusement. Do you receive many requests for such commodities? Enough. Unfortunately, an uninformed public tends to confuse scholarship with magicianry, and love life seems to be that factor which requires the largest quantity of magical tinkering. And so would seem most natural. But I differ. I connect scholarship with nothing but the means of answering difficult questions. The Siwenian considered somberly, "You may be as wrong as they." That may be or not. The young general set down his cup in its flaring sheath, and it refilled. He dropped the offered flavor capsule into it with a small splash. "Tell me then, patrician, who are the magicians, the real ones?" Barr seemed startled at a title long unused. He said, "There are no magicians." "But people speak of them. Siwenna crawls with the tales of them. There are cults being built around them. There is some strange connection between it and those groups among your countrymen who dream and drivel of ancient days and what they call liberty and autonomy. Eventually, the matter might become a danger to the state." The old man shook his head. "Why ask me? Do you smell rebellion with myself at the head?" Rio shrugged. "Never. Never. Oh, it is not a thought completely ridiculous. Your father was an exile in his day. You yourself a patriot and a chauvinist in yours. It is indelicate in me as a guest to mention it, but my business here requires it. And yet, a conspiracy now? I doubt it. Siwenia has had the spirit beat out of it these three generations." The old man replied with difficulty, "I shall be as indelicate a host as you a guest. I shall remind you that once a viceroy thought as you did of the spiritless Siwenians. By the orders of that viceroy, my father became a fugitive pauper, my brothers martyrs, and my sister a suicide. Yet that viceroy died a death sufficiently horrible at the hands of these same slavish Siwenians." "Ah, yes. And there you touch nearly on something I could wish to say. For 3 years, the mysterious death of that viceroy has been no mystery to me. There was a young soldier of his personal guard whose actions were of interest. You were that soldier. But there is no need of details, I think." Barr was quiet. "None. What do you propose? That you answer my questions. Not under threats. I am old, but not yet so old that life means particularly overmuch." "My good sir, these are hard times," said Rios with meaning. "And you have children and friends. You have a country for which you have mouthed phrases of love and folly in the past. Come, if I should decide to use force, my aim would not be so poor as to strike you." Barr said coldly, "What do you want?" Rios held the empty cup as he spoke. "Patrician, listen to me. These are days when the most successful soldiers are those whose function is to lead the dress parades that wind through the imperial palace grounds on feast days, and to escort the sparkling pleasure ships that carry his imperial splendor to the summer planets. I am a failure. I am a failure at 34, and I shall stay a failure. Because, you see, I like to fight. That's why they sent me here. I'm too troublesome at court. I don't fit in with the etiquette. I offend the dandies and the Lord Admirals. But I'm too good a leader of ships and men to be disposed of shortly by being marooned in space. So Siwenna is the substitute. It's a frontier world, a rebellious and a barren province. It is far away, far enough to satisfy all. And so I molder. There are no rebellions to stamp down, and the border viceroys do not revolt lately. At least not since His Imperial Majesty's late father of glorious memory made an example of Mountel of Parame." "A strong emperor," muttered Barr. "Yes, and we need more of them. He is my master. Remember that. These are his interests I guard." Barr shrugged unconcernedly. "How does all this relate to the subject?" "I'll show you in two words. The magicians I've mentioned come from beyond, out there beyond the frontier guards, where the stars are scattered thinly, where the stars are scattered thinly, quoted Barr, and the cold of space seeps in. Is that poetry? Rios frowned. Verse seemed frivolous at the moment. In any case, they're from the periphery, from the only quarter where I am free to fight for the glory of the Emperor, and thus serve His Imperial Majesty's interests and satisfy your own love of a good fight. Exactly. But I must know what I fight, and there you can help. How do you know? Rios nibbled casually at a cakelet. Because for 3 years I have traced every rumor, every myth, every breath concerning the magicians. And of all the library of information I have gathered, only two isolated facets are unanimously agreed upon, and are hence certainly true. The first is that the magicians come from the edge of the galaxy opposite Siwenna. The second is that your father once met a magician, alive and actual, and spoke with him. The aged Siwenian stared unblinkingly, and Rios continued. You had better tell me what you know. Barr said thoughtfully, It would be interesting to tell you certain things. It would be a psycho-historic experiment of my own. What kind of experiment? Psycho-historic. The old man had an unpleasant edge to his smile. Then crisply, You'd better have more tea. I'm going to make a bit of a speech. He leaned far back into the soft cushions of his chair. The wall lights had softened into a pink ivory glow, which mellowed even the soldier's hard profile. Dukembar began, My own knowledge is the result of two accidents, the accidents of being born the son of my father, and of being born the native of my country. It begins over 40 years ago, shortly after the Great Massacre, when my father was a fugitive in the forests of the south, while I was a gunner in the viceroy's personal fleet. This same viceroy, by the way, who had ordered the massacre, and who died such a cruel death thereafter. Barr smiled grimly and continued. My father was a patrician of the Empire and a senator of Siwenna. His name was Onum Barr. Rios interrupted impatiently. I know the circumstances of his exile very well. You needn't elaborate upon it. The Siwenian ignored him and proceeded without deflection. During his exile, a wanderer came upon him, a merchant from the edge of the galaxy, a young man who spoke a strange accent, knew nothing of recent imperial history, and who was protected by an individual force shield. An individual force shield? Rios glared. You speak extravagance. What generator could be powerful enough to condense a shield to the size of a single man? By the great galaxy, did he carry 5,000 myriad tons of atomic power source about with him on a little wheeled go-cart? Barr said quietly, This is the magician of whom you hear whispers, stories, and myths. The name magician is not lightly earned. He carried no generator large enough to be seen, but not the heaviest weapon you can carry in your hand would have as much as creased the shield he bore. Is this all the story there is? Are the magicians born of maunderings of an old man, broken by suffering and exile? The story of the magicians antedated even my father, sir, and the proof is more concrete. After leaving my father, this merchant that men call a magician visited a tech man at the city to which my father had guided him, and there he left a shield generator of the type he wore. That generator was retrieved by my father after his return from exile upon the execution of the bloody viceroy. It took a long time to find. The generator hangs on the wall behind you, sir. It does not work. It never worked but for the first 2 days. But if you'll look at it, you will see that no one in the Empire ever designed it. Belrios reached for the belt of linked metal that clung to the curved wall. It came away with a little sucking noise as the tiny adhesion field broke at the touch of his hand. The ellipsoid at the apex of the belt held his attention. It was the size of a walnut. This, he said, was the generator, nodded Barr. But it was the generator. The secret of its workings are beyond discovery now. Sub-electronic investigations have shown it to be fused into a single lump of metal, and not all the most careful study of the diffraction patterns have sufficed to distinguish the discrete parts that had existed before fusion, then your proof still lingers on the frothy border of words backed by no concrete evidence. Barr shrugged. You have demanded my knowledge of me and threatened its extortion by force. If you choose to meet it with skepticism, what is that to me? Do you want me to stop? Go on, said the general harshly. I continued my father's researches after he died, and then the second accident I mentioned came to help me, for Sewena was well known to Harry Seldon. And who is Harry Seldon? Harry Seldon was a scientist of the reign of the Emperor Dalyubin IV. He was a psychohistorian, the last and greatest of them all. He once visited Sewena, when Sewena was a great commercial center, rich in the arts and sciences. Muttered Rio sourly. Where is the stagnant planet that does not claim to have been a land of overflowing wealth in older days? The days I speak of are the days of 2 centuries ago, when the Emperor yet ruled to the uttermost star, when Sewena was a world of the interior and not a semi-barbarian border province. In those days, Harry Seldon foresaw the decline of imperial power and the eventual barbarization of the entire galaxy. Rios laughed suddenly. He foresaw that? Then he foresaw wrong, my good scientist. I suppose you call yourself that. Why, the Empire is more powerful now than it has been in a millennium. Your old eyes are blinded by the cold bleakness of the border. Come to the inner world some day. Come to the warmth and the wealth of the center. The old man shook his head somberly. Circulation ceases first at the outer edges, and it will take a while yet for the decay to reach the heart. That is, the apparent, obvious to all decay, as distinct from the inner decay that is an old story of some 15 centuries. And so this Harry Seldon foresaw a galaxy of uniform barbarism, said Rios good-humoredly. And what then, huh? So he established 2 foundations at the extreme opposing ends of the galaxy. Foundations of the best and the youngest and the strongest. They are to breed, grow, and develop. The worlds on which they were placed were chosen carefully, as were the times and the surroundings. All was arranged in such a way that the future, as foreseen by the unalterable mathematics of psychohistory, would involve their early isolation from the main body of imperial civilization and their gradual growth into the germs of the Second Galactic Empire, cutting an inevitable barbarian interregnum from 30,000 years to scarcely a single thousand. And where did you find out all this? You seem to know it in detail. I don't, and never did, said the patrician with composure. It is the painful result of the piecing together of certain evidence discovered by my father, and a little more found by myself. The basis is flimsy, and the superstructure has been romanticized into existence to fill the huge gaps. But I am convinced that it is essentially true. You are easily convinced. Am I? It has taken 40 years of research. 40 years. I could settle the question in 40 days. In fact, I believe I ought to. It would be different. And how would you do that? In the obvious way, I would become an explorer. I could find this foundation you speak of and observe with my eyes. You say there are 2? The records speak of 2. Supporting evidence has been found only for 1, which is understandable, for the other is at the extreme end of the long axis of the galaxy. Well, we'll visit the near one. The general was on his feet, adjusting his belt. You know where to go? Asked Barr. In a way. In the records of the last viceroy but one, he whom you murdered so effectively, there are suspicious tales of outer barbarians. In fact, one of his daughters was given in marriage to a barbarian prince. I'll find my way. He held out a hand. I thank you for your hospitality. Dukembar touched the hand with his fingers and bowed formally. Your visit was a great honor. As for the information you gave me, continued Belrios, I'll know how to thank you for that when I return. Dukembar followed his guest submissively to the outer door and said quietly to the disappearing ground car, "And if you return..." Chapter 2, The Magicians. Foundation. With 40 years of expansion behind them, the Foundation faced the menace of Rios. The epic days of Hardin and Mallow had gone, and with them a certain hard daring and resolution. Encyclopedia Galactica. There were four men in the room, and the room was set apart where none could approach. The four men looked at each other quickly, then lengthily at the table that separated them. There were four bottles on the table, and as many glasses, but no one had touched them. And then the man nearest the door stretched out an arm and drummed a slow, padding rhythm on the table. He said, "Are you going to sit and wonder forever? Does it matter who speaks first?" "Speak you first, then," said the big man directly opposite. "You're the one who should be the most worried." Senate Farrell chuckled with noiseless non-humor. "Because you think I'm the richest. Well, or is it that you expect me to continue as I have started? I don't suppose you forget that it was my own trade fleet that captured this scout ship of theirs." "You had the largest fleet," said a third, "and the best pilots, which is another way of saying you are the richest. It was a fearful risk, and would have been greater for one of us." Senate Farrell chuckled again. "There is a certain facility in risk-taking that I inherit from my father. After all, the essential point in running a risk is that the returns justify it. As to which, witness the fact that the enemy ship was isolated and captured without loss to ourselves or warning to the others." That Farrell was a distant collateral relative of the late great Hober Mallow was recognized openly throughout the Foundation. That he was Mallow's illegitimate son was accepted quietly to just as wide an extent. The fourth man blinked his little eyes stealthily. Words crept out from between thin lips. "It is nothing to sleep over in fat triumph, this grasping of little ships. Most likely, it will but anger that young man further." "You think he needs motives?" questioned Farrell scornfully. "I do. And this might, or will, save him the vexation of having to manufacture one." The fourth man spoke slowly. "Hober Mallow worked otherwise, and Salvor Hardin. They let others take the uncertain paths of force, while they maneuvered surely and quietly." Farrell shrugged. "The ship has proved its value. Motives are cheap, and we have sold this one at a profit." There was the satisfaction of the born trader in that. He continued, "The young man is of the old empire." "We knew that," said the second man, the big one, with rumbling discontent. "We suspected that," corrected Farrell softly. "If a man comes with ships and wealth, with overtures of friendliness, and with offers of trade, it is only sensible to refrain from antagonizing him until we are certain that the profitable mask is not a face after all. But now..." There was a faint whining edge to the third man's voice as he spoke. "We might have been even more careful. We might have found out first. We might have found out before allowing him to leave. It would have been the truest wisdom." "That has been discussed and disposed of," said Farrell. He waved the subject aside with a flatly final gesture. "The government is soft," complained the third man. "The mayor is an idiot." The fourth man looked at the other three in turn and removed the stub of a cigar from his mouth. He dropped it casually into the slot at his right, where it disappeared with a silent flash of disruption. He said sarcastically, "I trust the gentleman who spoke last is speaking through habit only. We can afford to remember here that we are the government." There was a murmur of agreement. The fourth man's little eyes were on the table. "Then let us leave government policy alone. This young man, this stranger, might have been a possible customer. There have been cases. All three of you tried to butter him into an advance contract. We have an agreement, a gentleman's agreement against it. But you tried." "So did you," growled the second man. I know it, said the fourth calmly. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.